Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sean.
And expected to join us a little later will be Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Tim Wood will join us by phone. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And we hope to hear from Nelson Siegelman as well, the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and Islands. Another packed week of news and information here in our region. And we can start with Senator Dan Wolf dropping his run for governor because he just couldn't clear up this issue with the Ethics Commission.
Yeah, it was going to take too long, he said. It was possibly going to take through the end of this year to get a definitive ruling on this and whether they would allow this amendment to the ethics laws. It just wouldn't have given him enough time, he says, to raise the kind of money you need for a governor's race.
And it seems so clear. There didn't seem to be anyone coming up and saying, look, clearly, if he has this relationship with Cape Air, and they have a contract with Massport, this is a clear conflict. Instead, we hear folks saying, this doesn't appear to be a conflict. He can't influence that contract at all. It's kind of just a set thing. But they couldn't seem to come up with any type of, fix.
Right. It's it seems pretty cut and dry. You know, he has this company that he at this point only owns 20% in, has a contract. You know, he can't influence it in any way as a politician, either raise the price or lower the price. And so a lot of people saw it that way, and a lot of people rallied in support of him. Lots of key officials, including some judges, and the ball seemed to be rolling toward a resolution on this. But he said, he had very pointed comments to Ryan Barber this week that the Ethics Commission wasn't moving very quickly on this. They didn't seem to want to fix it in a timely manner to allow him to get on the ballot or to run a campaign the way he thinks he needs to run it. He said they could have held some special meetings.
Sure.
The commission only meets, I guess, once a month. And they were sticking to that schedule, and the timeline just wasn't lining up for a governor's run here.
And again, of course, this was something that could have been brought up at the beginning of his term in the Senate. So now it appears he's going to decide, what, in February, perhaps, whether he's going to try to retain his Senate seat?
That's right. And that, there's a domino effect here. People were already lining up. Representative Sarah Peek was gearing up to run for Wolf's Senate seat, if he was going to run for governor. And then there were other people who were going to step in and run for state rep in that area. So this will narrow the window for those people. You know, they're going to have to, keep a watchful eye on what Wolf does. Mm. And, it will limit the amount of time that they have to campaign and raise money for those seats as well.
Well, the field is becoming clear for governor, more clear anyway. Of course, we have Attorney General Martha Coakley during this period when Dan Wolf was trying to sort out whether he was going to be able to run or not. Coakley has stepped up. Looks like she's going to run. I'm sure she's going to be, the front runner right away. And then the Republican field, I think it's just Charlie Baker.
That's right. And, you have a formidable candidate there in
sure.
Martha Coakley. She's already run for statewide office, so she's got that name recognition already and the ability to raise money. She raised a lot of money to run for U.S. Senate, and she certainly will be able to raise money to run for governor. So I'm sure Wolf and Wolf's campaign looked at that and said, we're up against it here, and the timeline's just not working out.
Right. Let's move on to the Mashpee Wampanoag and their bid for a casino. As we've talked about in previous years, there's a couple processes going on all at the same time, and one of them involves getting the land into trust. The land that the tribe says is theirs historically has to be put into trust by the federal government, and then things can fall in line after that for the you explain it. You cover this.
Right. Well, to get the land into trust at the federal level, there's a lot of requirements, and it's a lengthy process. No one can put a time element on that. The tribe puts its positive spin on it, mm-hmm. and casino opponents say, it's going to take a lot longer. This week, there was a step in the process here. The Mashpee Wampanoag got notice from the Department of Interior that the environmental impact statement, the federal impact statement, will go up on the Federal Register. And that sets in motion more public hearings on that, and also potentially a final decision. When that will come, you know, that's anybody's guess. Anybody who's watched environmental reviews in the past knows it can take anywhere from a few months to a few years. So the tribe is saying, you know, we think this is going to go fairly smoothly, that there weren't a lot of things in the draft that needed to be taken care of. And so they see it moving along fairly quickly. The opponents, of course, are pointing out that, you know, other tribes have been in this situation and it's taken them years, you know, as many as 2 years from draft to final.
What is the Bureau of Indian Affairs looking for? Are they looking at historic roots to the land? Is that primarily it?
That's part of it. That's definitely part of it. The tribe has to show some historic ties to the land. And so they've had researchers working for the past couple of years to show just how the Mashpee Wampanoag lines up with Taunton. Now, the Mashpee Wampanoag are part of a much larger tribe. They were known as the Pawkinaket in those days. And there, I believe there were like 17 different tribes, but they all fell under one leader. We know that leader as Massasoit in our history books. And so the Mashpee Wampanoag, one of those tribes, and they say that Taunton was a prime site for them for hunting, fishing. The Taunton River, of course, was used by them to navigate, to travel. They Wampanoag Indians did not stay in one place. They moved around because of the seasons, hunting, fishing, those mm-hmm. types of things. So they've made their case. The BIA has not ruled on that yet.
If we can remember back to when the tribe was actually going to build in Middleborough, and then that deal fell apart, the tribe still owns that land in Middleborough. Is that right? Is that part of this package into trust?
It isn't. They have taken that out of their land into trust application. They no longer the ownership of that is tricky because it was the previous investors who actually purchased that land.
Oh.
And or had the right of first refusal on that land. And so that's still up in the air. Middleborough officials will tell you they want answers from the tribe. They had an agreement with the tribe to build a casino, as you know, in Middleborough. They say that that's never been fully resolved. The tribe says it has. At some point, I think in the future, it's probably going to wind up in some court.
I see. Let's move on to talk about the Falmouth wind turbines. There are two town-owned wind turbines on Route 28 in Falmouth. They've been the source of tremendous controversy since they began operating, neighbors complaining of health effects because of those turbines, and other folks in town saying, well, we don't quite believe that. So now it was in front of a judge, at least part of this issue was. Talk about what the judge was looking at.
Well, the judge gave these people some reason for hope, these people who say that it affects their sleep and their way of life. He said there's a likelihood of success in their legal battle. At issue here is a Falmouth Zoning Board of Appeals ruling. The zoning board ruled that the rhythmic noise and pressure was causing physical and psychological effects. And they said that the building commissioner should not have issued a building permit for these turbines. So
right. I think the issue was that the folks said, well, we have it here in the town bylaws that any turbine has to go for a special permit process, a more expanded permitting process than what normally would be required. And but the building inspector said, no, this is for town use. You don't need the special permit process. Here is your building permit. And that's what's being debated here, that building permit.
That's right. And these people, you know, with the judge hasn't ruled on the case, but
right.
him giving this preliminary finding that there's a likelihood of success is something that they're hanging their hat on. He's told both sides they have until October 30th to submit further briefs on their side, and then he's scheduled a hearing for November 7th. So
meanwhile, there's still a lot of discussion about what hours those turbines will be spinning. Of course, the original plan was to have them spin as often as the wind would blow them. But now we've had different amount of hours reductions. It was at 12 and 12 on and off, and now what is it, 16 and 8, I think?
16 and 8, yeah.
16 right. Operating, 8 off.
They shut it off from 9 o'clock at night until 5 a.m., and the health board is considering that at this point.
Oh, so the Board of Health may weigh in on that.
That's right.
Is that long enough if you've got kids in school or if you need to go to work? Are you going to be able to function if you're affected profoundly by these turbines?
That's correct. Right.
What a mess this turbine issue is here in Falmouth.
It is. And, we have turbines on the military base.
Right.
And there's virtually no complaint about those. I mean, they're not located near houses. So I guess that would be the primary reason. But, mm-hmm. I mean, they continue to put up turbines on the land at Joint Base Cape Cod and with no repercussions at all. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think we saw two additional ones now. When you go over the Sagamore, you can see four prominent military-based located turbines there.
Right, and the National Guard is talking about a fifth in that same vicinity.
Let's move on and talk about Gina Clark. And people may remember this story. Gina Clark is in prison now.
Right. She ran this organization people may have heard of, Touched by Angels. She was convicted of embezzling money from the people that she was trying to help here. People were promised money for cancer treatments. People were promised money, when some loved one in their family was killed. And a judge has now ruled that, along with her being in prison, that she must make restitution of $148,000 to these families. And it's broken down, in terms of what she promised that she was going to do for them. And in many respects, her organization, this nonprofit organization, came up well short of what she had promised.
Mm. Yeah, the reason I mentioned it, there were so many people affected by this. Either they went to these fundraisers thinking that the money would be passed along to the families who needed it, or families themselves were affected in the midst of their grief or tragedy. So this is a terrible story, but it looks like there is some restitution coming.
Yeah, that restitution, by the way, won't come until she gets out of prison, which is, she was sentenced to 4 to 5 years.
So she's going to get out, presumably make the money, and then...
Right.
I see. Okay. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to hear from Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner, about all happenings out in Provincetown.
Whales. It's a lot nicer than the whale watch, up in Provincetown because, first of all, it doesn't cost anything more than, I've already got invested. Secondly, it's not as crowded as the boat.
Roy Reining at the beach in Truro.
It's a nice way to enjoy cetaceans, whales. It's a nice way to enjoy them, without having to go through driving and parking a car and buying a ticket and waiting in line and getting on a boat and fighting the crowd to get a spot on the rail of the boat to see the whale when the captain finally gets up close enough to him. And then you got the issue of some folks get a little seasick.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH. Online at capeandislands.org.
On one fateful night in 1938, thousands of men and women ran from their homes convinced that Martians were invading, all because of a radio play.
But there is one thing we must not overlook. All this took place in 1938, in a less sophisticated yesteryear.
Okay, were we really so unsophisticated back then? Could the War of the Worlds happen again? Here's a hint, yes. We'll find out on the next Radio Lab, where we'll come to you.
Live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Sunday afternoon at 3.
And joining us on the phone is Sally Rose, editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Sally. Welcome to the News Roundup.
Good morning, Tom.
And much of the news in Provincetown is centered on the police department in recent months. Sallytown meeting this week also included quite a bit of discussion about that issue. What happened?
That's right, Sean. Well, the special town meeting voters gave their thumbs up to buying the VFW property. That was for $900,000. Originally, that was to be to use as a police station, but voters decided they didn't want to specify it for any particular use like that, although some selectmen were hoping that they would, and that was the way the article was originally written. They just agreed that it was simply a good deal for the town, whether it's ultimately used for a police station, for affordable housing, sold for profit, whatever. Interestingly, though, Provincetown residents at the town meeting still seemed to be, as you mentioned, in quite a contentious mood. There was a lot of feisty debate that Monday evening. As you all know, the community has been in a very divisive state over several incidents involving reported actions by the police chief. And although the police chief was suspended by the selectman and town manager in mid-September, pending an investigation into these incidents that's ongoing now, many residents still seem intent at the meeting on sending a message to town leaders. Another indication of this was the vote, Sean, on the Marine Patrol Officer Program. That's the two-year pilot program that has had police manning the pier in addition to the harbor masters. But after listening to several residents pan that program, voters decided to pass a non-binding article that, if heeded, would then defund the program.
So you think the scrutiny that the department is under overall really affected both these votes?
I do. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's as you say, the scrutiny of the department. I think it's also that the reason this is sort of still ongoing is because of the lack of immediate response by town leaders. They were very slow to sort of get on board and understand that there were some problems here. They're certainly doing that now, but apparently residents don't quite trust that yet. So,
how was the turnout for town meeting?
It was pretty low. It was on the low side. I think there was some maybe 200 or so people that turned out.
I see. And now that the town will own the VFW building, does that purchase have to go to some sort of townwide vote or anything?
It does not, because it originally was going to have to go to a ballot vote, and there will be a ballot vote on November 5th. But because the town leaders decided to buy it with free cash, that ballot vote will be basically moot.
Oh, okay. So it would only go to a ballot vote if it was going to affect the tax rate.
Right.
I see.
Exactly.
Okay, any other issues out of town meeting or anything else you want to talk about with Provincetown this week?
There's so many, but...
I love Provincetown, I tell you.
There's always fun going on. Another vote that that voters also decided to pass, and it was nearly unanimous, was the Medical Marijuana Treatment Center bylaw. And that will allow dispensaries to be located in two areas of town, one's on Shank Painter Road and another's on Harry Kemp Way, as long as they're 100 feet away from schools or daycare centers. So that should be interesting. There's a group of local people who are looking to... They've managed to pass the first level of application with the state, and they're moving on to the second, so it'll remain to be seen whether that's successful.
That's great. I think Mashpee also at its town meeting this week also passed an item that would allow a location for a marijuana dispensary. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. She joins us during the news roundup every Friday. Thanks, Sally. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Bye, Sally. And with me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. George, I want to talk about a story you've been following for a couple years now, it seems. The school superintendent, or former school superintendent, Mary Ellen Johnson in Sandwich, has been battling about her contract, and there's so much behind this in terms of votes to terminate the contract. No, the vote wasn't legitimate. Try to encapsulate this for us.
This all started in April of 2010. With a vote to renew her contract for 2 years. The initial vote was supposed to happen on April 28th. there were some questions about the contract. 2 days later, at a recessed meeting, they did vote to renew her contract for 2 years. But that meeting was not properly posted.
Right.
So that was the first kicker. Then a town election happened, and two of Mary Ellen Johnson's supporters had left the board. Two opponents were elected in that town election. And so now suddenly she went from a majority of the board supporting her to a majority of the board who opposed her. And so a couple of months later, with all of this stuff swirling about whether the meeting was legitimate to extend her contract in the first place, in June of that year, the newly formed board voted not to extend her contract, and in fact to tell her at the end of her 3-year contract, which was 1 year later, that she would be done with the Sandwich Schools and they were going to start looking for a new superintendent.
Okay.
She ultimately filed suit as a result of that, saying she had a binding contract, that if the town officials thought that there was an illegal meeting, that they had 21 days to take that to court to challenge the validity of her contract. They never did that. And so almost 3 years later here, a judge has ruled that her contract was indeed valid. He, in fact, went so far as to say that that meeting was legal because the school board chairman at the time, Robert Simmons, said the meeting was going to be recessed on community television, and it was published in the local newspaper that it was a recessed meeting. And there was a posting that did go up on the bulletin board in the school, not the town clerk's office. So he said the spirit was there. I mean, they weren't trying to hide anything here.
Right, right.
So in that respect, he found that it was a legal meeting. And so that's a new twist to all of this. Ultimately, the bottom line is she had $300,000 of salary in that contract that she's never received. Her attorney says that's the starting point for the settlement that the judge has ordered in this case. The judge hasn't set a dollar amount. He said both sides, you have to get together, figure out an amount, and bring it to me, and I'll decide whether it's fair or not. Now, whether they can get together and do that is another story. There's been a lot of tension between the school department and Mary Ellen Johnson. So whether they can sit down and come to an agreement remains to be seen. But they'll both file what they think is the right amount, and then the judge will decide how much she's going to get paid. But she's going to get paid, it would seem, from this ruling by the judge.
Well, I got the sense, just reading the reporting in the story today, that town officials seem somewhat relieved that this is at least concluded, or at least appears to be almost concluded.
I think that is the general sense in town, that this has been hanging over them for a couple of years now, that they really need to get beyond this. There's a new superintendent now. There's things he's trying to do, and to have this type of an issue hanging over them just hasn't been good for the faculty. It hasn't been good for the students, and they need to move on, get beyond Mary Ellen Johnson, and do what they want to do with the school system.
Do you know if she's working someplace else now?
She has had difficulty getting another job. In fact, a couple of years ago, maybe a year ago now to 18 months ago, she was a finalist for a job. Of course, all of the news clippings came up about some of the shenanigans between her and the school committee, and ultimately she did not get that job.
Right. Okay. Tim Wood is joining us on the phone. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Sean.
And you're at your office this morning?
I am indeed.
And that's in Chatham?
It is indeed.
Okay. And Chatham took a vote on pay as you throw. And this is a trend, shall I say. The community is looking at pay as you throw for our garbage. And how did it go in Chatham?
Well, Chatham didn't follow the lead of some other local towns, such as Brewster and Wellfleet, which chose to go with the pay-as-you-throw option, where residents are required to purchase specific types of trash bags to dispose of their solid waste. In Chatham, the selectmen heard from their Solid Waste Advisory Committee, which has been studying this issue for about a year, and the committee was split, with the majority favoring pay-as-you-throw, but the minority figuring that the cost of that would be higher than what residents are paying now with just a dump sticker. And the selectmen sided with that minority, and they decided that the extra cost isn't worth it right now, even though the whole point of this is to try to decrease the amount of solid waste that the town generates in light of the fact that the new solid waste contract with either CMAS or ABC or whoever ends up getting that contract in 2015 is going to increase the town's costs of, by about $200,000 a year. The board figured that the town has to reduce its solid waste mainly through recycling. The options for doing that were either pay-as-you-throw or increasing education, and the selectmen decided that let's try to increase education, let's try to encourage people to recycle more. We'll do that first. If that doesn't work, we'll take another look at pay-as-you-throw maybe in a year or a year and a half or so.
Hey, Tim, George Brennan here. In Sandwich, where they launched pay-as-you-throw a couple of years ago, it increased recycling dramatically. It sort of forces people, to look at, their habits and what they're going to throw away, because they are suddenly paying for what they're putting in the bags. Mm. And
that's the contention here is that, you either force people to do it and they're going to do it or not, or you try to take a more light-handed approach and encourage them to do it. And Chatham isn't willing to go to that next step where, people are going to have to take a look at their habits. One thing they're worried about is the commercial waste haulers in town, which aren't really recycling as much as the residents. The committee in town here says if you just look at the residents who go to the dump, they recycle about 50%. But when you throw in the commercial waste haulers and then factor in the recycling rate, it goes down to about 37%.
Oh, boy. In the town of Mashpee, where I live, I called my commercial waste hauler and I said, I'd like to recycle. How does that work? And they were going to charge me extra. I think it was $6 a week. So I called the town, and the town said, oh, they're not supposed to do that. And I said, well, what are you going to do about it? And they said, well, there's not much we can do about it, but they're not supposed to do that. Well, that's what they're doing. So obviously, I think we need to get a handle on what's going on with recycling here on Cape Cod. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, the selectmen are hoping to get the commercial waste haulers who operate in town to come in and talk about this, because that is a really key factor in trying to reduce solid waste.
Sure. Let's talk about Cumberland Farms. This is local. I mean, when a new Cumberland Farm store is coming to your community, it's kind of a big deal. What's happening with Cumberland Farms in Chatham?
Well, Chatham has an interesting case because we already have a Cumberland Farm store that's been there for quite a while. A little bit up the road from that, right at the downtown Rotary, which is if you're familiar with Chatham, that's the sort of entryway to our downtown area, our downtown business district. There used to be a service station, a mobile station at the Rotary. That was there for about 50 years. It closed in 2008 and was converted into a Christie's Market. And we all know what happened with Christie's Market. Store closed about 14 months later, and it's been vacant since. And last year, Cumberland Farms came in with some plans to take over that property. They didn't get very far. They ran into some opposition, not because of the store itself, but because of the design. And they returned a couple weeks ago to town boards with a new design, which, again, met with a little bit of skepticism in design. Chatham has a Historic Business District Commission, which controls the design of structures within the business zone, which this is right smack in the middle of. And members thought that this proposed design that Cumberland Farms came in with was just a little too big and a little too, I don't know how else to put it, but a little too not Chatham.
Okay, I get it. I get it. Yeah, not Chatham. It's clear.
Sent them back to the drawing board, and they were the Cumberland Farms folks were okay with this. I think they expected to have some back and forth on this, And they were at the planning board again this week, and they said they will be reducing the size of that design and coming in with a new facade to make it look a little more in keeping with some of the older structures in the area.
Got it. I like it. Okay. Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks. Thanks, Tim, as usual. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. Talk to you next week. With me here in Woods Hole is George Brennan. He's a senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And George, Scott Brown was back on Cape Cod, and folks may remember this was where he made a big, big, big scene for himself as he was running for that Senate position. And now he's back, and he's fundraising, or he's helping fundraise. What was he doing here?
Yeah, he was at a fundraiser for Sheriff James Cummings. And really, this was more about Scott Brown being here than the fundraiser for Cummings. We don't even know if Cummings is going to run for re-election in 3 years. There's been a lot of talk that Jeff Perry, who's a special sheriff, will eventually take over for Cummings and run for that office, although there's nothing official on that yet. So Cummings held this fundraiser, and Brown was the keynote speaker there. And he talked more about himself than he did about Sheriff Cummings. He talked about, you know, what he was going to do, what he potentially might do in his next battle.
His next battle.
What is that next battle? Well, we don't know. And, of course, we sent a reporter there to try and find out. He talked a lot about his trip to Japan recently. He talked about how China is what China is doing in terms of poking at Japan with drones and flying into their airspace and those types of things. Those sound like national issues to me.
International issues, yeah.
International issues, exactly.
George, go ahead. Are you hinting that Scott Brown may be running for president?
Well, you know, you look at the evidence here, and he's been to Iowa. He tweeted out this morning that his weekend travels are going to take him to Colorado and to Florida. He's looking forward to getting back home, but nonetheless, he's getting on planes this weekend to go to two other states. There's been some talk about him running for Senate in New Hampshire against Gene Shaheen. He owns a house up there. Everybody's waiting for what is the next move of Scott Brown.
Right. He gained a lot of national attention when he was in the Senate, taking what was sometimes called the Kennedy seat. A Republican taking that Kennedy seat, as it was called, was quite a surprise.
I think he famously called it the people's seat, didn't he?
Yes,
and,
he did.
You know, one of the things that may have turned that race around in his favor is he really resonated with the people, with the pickup truck, one-liners like that, at a time when people did want to connect with whoever the next senator was going to be. And famously, Martha Coakley made a comment, I think it was around the time the Red Sox were in the playoffs, or they might have been toward the end of the season, and she didn't want to stand out in the cold and greet voters outside of Fenway Park.
Right.
And so here's a guy connecting with people and someone with a bit of a disconnect at that point. And so, you know, he always, wherever he goes, he always brings some intrigue. I don't think any of us believes that the next battle is whatever show he's going to be on the Fox News channel.
Well, you're referring to the fact that he was a paid Fox commentator after he lost his bid for re-election.
Right. And, you know, nobody thinks that that's going to be the long-term career move for Scott Brown. There's some run out there, you know, whether he can win again in Massachusetts, because of the heavily Democratic state, you know, that remains to be seen. But could he move to New Hampshire, where there is more of a Republican base? That's possible. And, you know, a potential bid for the presidency, you know, could be in his future.
Okay. Let's talk about the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims' arrival. And when is that?
It's in 1620, and, you know, Provincetown loves to point out, and, you know, they have a monument to this. It's maybe the largest structure on Cape Cod. I don't even know. But that the Pilgrims first landed in Provincetown,
right,
that the Mayflower Compact, indeed, was written offshore in Provincetown. And they're saying that they need to get their act together and start working toward a 400th anniversary, because Plymouth, where Thanksgiving, as we all know, is celebrated heavily and is considered the birth of our Thanksgiving, is already raising money. They already have a committee in place. They have an executive director. They're even getting a license plate developed by the state of Massachusetts, where you can get a license plate for the 400th anniversary, and that will raise some money for their celebration.
Again, 7 years away.
7 years away.
Okay.
And they've already been doing this for a couple of years now. So, you know, Provincetown has a little bit of an inferiority complex here, where they're saying, you know, look, we were first. Jamestown, Virginia, also loves to say we were first. Plymouth people, I don't know if you know this, but I was a former editor of the Plymouth newspaper, the Old Colony Memorial. And what Plymouth people like to point out is there, that's the place where the Pilgrims actually wanted to be.
Oh.
You know, they took a look, good hard look at Provincetown, saw that the soil was not very good for planting, and decided to head on over to Plymouth, where they thought the soil was much better. Actually, they were looking for the Charles River, but, you know, that's a point that Plymouth likes to deflect.
Okay. I like it. A lot of intrigue. Okay. Nelson Siegelman is the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Time, and Nelson is joining us on the phone. Hi, Nelson. Nelson, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, good, good, good. I took a look at your paper today. Lots of happenings. I don't know what you want to talk about. Dog bites, road construction, school budget proposals. What should people know about this?
Well, there are a lot of things they should know about. I suppose we can talk about a variety of things, but certainly the school superintendent presented his draft budget for the next fiscal year, and that's going up 21.6% mostly on driven by special education.
21.6% increase year over year?
Yes, for next year. It's really an increase of almost $1 million. So we can imagine, and this is before we get to the various individual town budgets. So it's quite a lot. And school costs, that's something that towns across the island and the Cape deal with, and it's a lot.
How are the enrollment numbers? Any idea?
The enrollment numbers are up slightly, but this is driven, as I say, mostly it's a question of special education, and often as children who have special needs get older, those needs increase, the complexity increases, and also various state programs and mandates require that communities do more to help those children who do have special needs. And in a small community like Martha's Vineyard, it's a case of sometimes you have to send children off island to get special care, and that can be extremely expensive when you're doing something like that. So the school committee will be looking at this budget, and there'll be a lot to discuss.
Okay. What else would you like to discuss?
Well, we have a story this week about this very destructive wasp that is attacking black oaks across Martha's Vineyard. I assume it's something that probably people on the Cape are dealing with. You know, this time of the year, you look at the trees and you see the leaves getting brown. You think, oh, that's just a natural consequence of heading into the winter. But in fact, it's called a gall wasp. It's a very small, and it's been attacking black oaks and in some cases killing them. Successive infestations can make it difficult for the tree to rebound, and there's no real solution to the problem. It's if you recall, a number of years ago we had a problem with these caterpillars, the winter moth caterpillar. It was like something out of a horror film for a couple of years there, and then those little creatures died off. So I suppose this is part of a natural cycle, but if you have a black oak in your yard, it's not a happy thing to take it down.
Didn't they attack those winter moths with a small wasp that they set free as like a...
That was a one solution. I don't recall anybody releasing those around here, but that would be something wanted if they... Oh, that's the problem. It's part of that cycle. In fact, if you drive it through West Tisbury, there's an area where probably at least 80, 90 acres of oaks were died off due to these moths. And now you look up from the road and you can see a whole area where at some point those trees will eventually fall down and then something else will grow up in its place. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, according to environmentalists. If you get forests dying off and then new, younger growth coming up can be healthy.
Sure. George?
We had a story a couple of weeks ago on this. It is an issue here on Cape Cod as well, and I believe they're injecting something into the trees to try and stave this off.
Oh.
But it is a serious issue here as well.
Sure. Nelson, what about those dog bites? Why are they on the increase?
Well, yes, the Eggertown Animal Control Officer gave a report to Selectmen detailing an increase in various dog bites and dog calls. It wasn't a dramatic increase, but I wouldn't say there's one particular reason to it, but certainly there were a couple of sensational cases where we had one dog attack a miniature horse and in fact killed it. So at the same time, Barbara Prater reported that cat-related calls had decreased. So I don't know. I don't know what's responsible for that. Maybe the bad dogs are eating the good cats, and that meant that there was a decrease in those calls. She's also been involved with bats. When there are bats in the house, she needs to take particular care and make sure that the bats are not carrying rabies. So, it's part of living here.
Yeah, local stuff. All right, Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Pick up the paper, go to the website. Nelson, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
All right, talk to you later. And George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times, Cape Cod Online, is here in Woods Hole at our studio. And a story in today's paper about Stop and Shop buying the canal side property in Sandwich. Is it Sandwich or Bourne?
It's Bourne.
Bourne. We've been watching this property expecting a mixed use for years there of apartments and some retail, and now we don't know what's going to happen. Tell us, what's the latest?
Yeah, really, this has been a back and forth. It's been before the Cape Cod Commission. It's gone to the state level. And it's 152 acres. It was called Canalside Commons. People will know that this area, it's near the Bourne Bridge, the rotary on the Cape side of the canal. And this property had been set aside by Len Kubelis, a developer. What he wanted to do there was have a mix of retail and some housing and tweaked and tweaked and tweaked over the years, and then the bottom fell out of the economy, and there was a dispute between him and the family that owned the land. He was the developer. They owned the land, and that all wound up in court. In steps Stop and Shop, they've agreed to purchase this land for $10 million, and if they eventually build a supermarket there, they'll pay an extra, I think it's $500,000. And so they have no plans right at the moment for a supermarket. I think, they're going to step back and look and see what makes sense there in terms of whether there's going to be a mix between retail and housing there. Town planners say there's nothing before them from Stop and Shop at this point. Interesting to note here that up until a year ago when Market Basket opened, there wasn't a supermarket in Bourne. This potential could be a second one with Stop and Shop getting into the game.
Oh, though some folks in Bourne would rather have that second supermarket on the other side of the bridge.
Right. It's this would have both supermarkets on the Cape side. And Stop and Shop already has a huge presence. They in that area, they have a store in Sandwich. They have a store in Falmouth. They have a store in Wareham. They actually have two stores.
Two in Sandwich.
In Sandwich, right.
Yeah, and then Market Basket. I mean, that place is packed. You go up to the deli counter at Market Basket, it's like a stock exchange. It's an incredible sight, the amount of traffic that facility gets, and I think it's largely because of the prices.
Right. When you take a number at that deli, you could be taking a number for an hour.
Yeah.
You know, the few times my wife and I have gone to that store, it's quite a distance from our house, although we like the prices.
Right.
You know, we have to tag team it. One of us does the shopping, and the other one stands at the deli counter.
Well, it'd be interesting if Stop and Shop tried to go head-to-head with Market Basket, you know, within just a couple miles of the locations to see what happens, but I don't know. Okay, well, we'll just have to watch. Let's talk about the Dennis Yarmouth School District and its move here to bypass the Zoning Board of Appeals regarding these solar panels they wanted to install.
Well, this is an interesting twist, and Christine Laguerre, who's a reporter on this, calls it an end-around. I think that's a perfect way to describe this. The superintendent of schools has gone to the building department and said that the solar panels that they want to put up will have an educational component to them, and thus they don't have to go before the zoning board. They don't need the special permit that they were seeking to put these solar panels at the schools. As people might recall, the zoning board turned down the school department's request, and the school department, not taking no for an answer, sued and took it to court. And so you have a town board suing another town board, essentially, here, or a town department suing another town department. But this could make that moot. The superintendent believes that this educational use applies, and apparently the building inspector does too, or the building commissioner does too, because he has issued the building permits.
So the idea being that the kids can learn about renewable energy from these solar voltaic panels and such. Okay. And the idea was, well, maybe we didn't do the process correct before. We went through that zoning board. That didn't work out so well. So, we can use this educational component and go through that way. Now, it sounds like they're setting up a situation kind of similar to what happened here in Falmouth, where you've got the building inspector issuing a permit and other boards saying, well, perhaps that shouldn't be the case. And right now, as we said earlier in the hour, Falmouth is battling that in court.
That's right. It's almost an identical situation here. And it's going to be interesting. Does the zoning board fight back here? You know, do they turn around and say, you know, what the zoning board here in Falmouth has done and said, you're wrong in issuing that permit, that the educational use doesn't apply here. This isn't what the zoning board is initially saying, and they haven't taken any action. But what officials there are saying is that they don't think this is what the statute had in mind when they said, you know, if you're using something for an educational use, you can bypass the zoning board. That it was other potential uses. So I don't think this is the end of this, but certainly, as Christine put it, is sort of an end around that initial decision by the zoning board.
Okay, let's move on and talk about immunizations. There was an interesting article in the Times this week which pointed out some interesting statistics regarding how many people are getting their kids their shots here on Cape Cod.
Right. Well, I guess the state exemption rate is 1.5%. And here on the Cape and Islands, it's 4.5% of the kindergartners who go to school don't have the immunizations that the schools are looking for. And that could be either for medical reason or religious reasons. It's definitely caught the eye of public health officials who don't like the idea that, you know, the more kids who are in school without immunizations, they say, is going to drive up, you know, measles, mumps, and whooping cough, and those types of issues, which, you know, tend to then go through a school and, you know, get kids sick.
Yeah, they could be deadly, too.
They could. And in Frank, the only other county that's higher in the whole state of Massachusetts is Franklin County, where 6% of the incoming kindergartners have these types of exemptions. I learned a lot reading this story, actually. One of the things I learned is that all it takes to exempt your child, all the parent needs to do is write a letter to the school. You know, it's not as if you need a doctor's note or anything like that, or a note from your parish minister or your parish priest. All you need is to write a letter, you know, simply saying, for whatever reason, medical or religious, you know, you don't believe in immunization.
Right. And of course, what is probably behind much of this is concerns that these immunizations could lead to other health problems. I know that there was some reporting of potential links between immunizations and autism. Those have been discredited at this point, but I'm certain some of that still lingers out there.
Right. Well, the reporter quotes a Falmouth chiropractor who says, you know, his kids are perfectly healthy, but he has some of those concerns that vaccines could be linked to other immune disorders, you know, and he doesn't want to take this chance. He says his kids are perfectly healthy. Mm-hmm. They remain perfectly healthy despite not having these immunizations, and he doesn't want to take that chance. You know, as he says, he doesn't want his children injected with toxic substances in order to fight off whatever illness might be out there.
I see. Well, that's a tough issue, and we'll be watching it. Okay, and finally, George Brennan, the Red Sox. Speaking of watching, you've been watching the Red Sox?
I've been watching the Red Sox.
And any thoughts on how this might work out?
I think we're looking at a 7-game series. I absolutely do. It's going to be a tough battle. Red Sox headed to St. Louis, where they won't have the DH. Ortiz is going to have to play first base. Are we going to see some more Little League baseball with errors?
I know. Big Poppy on first base. How exciting. Well, that's what's happening. George Brennan joined me today here in Woods Hole. George is a senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thanks, George.
Thanks, Sean.
And great thanks to Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner and Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. They all called in. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.